Welcome to the last talk of the session, and our group is called WKB, which obviously stands for Worshippers of Carl Bender. And today, we're going to show you something truly amazing. You will be so incredibly powerful after what we have told you today. We're going to show you how you can sum up divergent series, just like that. It will be so easy. We're going to show you a semi-classical approximation for quantum mechanics that's going to enable you to solve really hard problems. And we're also going to show you a really neat thing about classical mechanics, what you get if you just allow for some complexity. It's going to be just great. I know you'll love it. So I give the floor to Bridget, who's going to tell us about divergent series.
Series. So we know that a divergent series does not converge, and one of the methods I will talk about is Euler. Now, Mr. Euler was, he was a Swiss, this is a piece of Swiss cheese here, mathematician and physicist, and he decided that when you're given a series, a non-convergent series, he said if it's of this form, where x is less than 1, his method found the solution as taking the limit as x goes to 1 of this function here. And then about 100 years later, Borel came along and he came. Does anyone know where he came from? Good, he came from France, so we'll give him a little beret. And he said that let's take this integral here, dt e to the negative t, t of n. And does anybody remember from lecture what this equals? Good. So when we have this non-convergent series here, he said, well, you know what? Let's not worry about this. Let's try to multiply this by 1 and then try to solve that, but using this. So how do we get 1 from this? Let's just divide this by what it's equal to and just plug that in over here. So get this in the numerator. And then his solution just said, let's simply take the summation first of this series with this an, and then we'll do this integral in here. So he found out, you know, if this integral actually exists for this series, you'll get that solution. But if it doesn't actually exist, you'll also find out that Euler's method over here also doesn't exist. And his method is actually more robust, and because you find out that this nth term of the series is over here, this nth term is divided by n factorial, so it actually has a much better chance of converging. So if you had a choice between those two, and this one works, this integral exists, let's use this. But you know, we have Euler here and we have Mr. Borel over there. What's to say that we can't just have any old person, or in this case, why not Rudolph? And I'm sorry, I don't have red chalk. Why can't he just come up with his own summation series? And he can, if he weren't a reindeer. And you need two properties, your machine. The first one, we want to make sure that it actually behaves like a sum. So in order to allow for that, the summation machine of some series should be equal to, the sum of some finite amount, and then apply that summation machine to the remainder of the terms. Now, second property that Mr. Rudolph needs to make sure he has is that since we know that these sums can't and don't follow associative or commutative properties necessarily, let's at least ensure that it follows linearity. So in order to ensure linearity, our summation machine needs to follow this property. Where we pull this coefficient alpha out and then apply that summation machine to an, and then sum it to beta times that summation machine again to there. So as long as Mr. Rudolph's summation machine follows those two properties, then things are satisfied and that works. And you also notice that both Borel and Euler's methods also follow these two properties. And then next I'll present Ali with his discussion.
Okay, now we know about two summation methods, Borel and Euler, but the disadvantage with these two or the other one is we have to know the whole series before we can do the summation. And so what's usually the case in our problems is that we don't know the whole series, we just know the few first terms, and then we want to sum up the whole series. For example, in that case of unharmonic oscillator, which we had, and like that, if we expand it over epsilon, we would end up with some divergent series, but we cannot calculate all of the terms. Yeah, for example, you're taking a shower. You're tired of all of these lectures and presentations. You're taking a shower, and then somebody comes at the door, knocks at the door, and gives you this series. And asks you how to sum up this. And you say, oh my God, it's not even steel cheese. And he's like, What do you mean by it's not a steel cheese? And you tell him, well, a steel cheese function is a function that, it has four conditions. It should be well defined in a cut plane. It should go to zero as x goes to infinity. And it should be expandable over x around x equals zero. And it should be Herglotz. And anyway, well, if a function is steel cheese, then it has a steel cheese series, and well, a very well-known steel cheese series condition, which it should be, which it should fit into, it's that it should turn sign. Its sign should change in each step, but it's clear it doesn't for this. So it's not a steel cheese. But you say, anyway, go ahead and do part A. You would hopefully find something, but there is no rigorous reason for you that you got something. But Anyway, you will get something. And what's pad A? You tell him if you have a function, f of x. Oh, no. If you have this theory. Yeah. Put x's all around like this. And then write your function as 2 like this. And yeah, where p and q are polynomials on x. And then evaluate it as x goes to 1. And you would get something. OK. Now you're really tired. You go to bed. And that random guy comes again and knocks this hard on the door and gives you the other series. And you're like, oh my god, this is not even Carleman. And you say, so, well, a Carleman series should, it should behave. It should not grow as fast as 2n factorial. Then pad A would give you an answer. But in this case, pad A would not give you an answer. But anyway, go and do pad A again. What you would end up with is, you see pad A's behave like this. And they do not converge to one limit, but to two limits. And that random guy looks at you like this and says, hey, man, I'm asking for an answer. And what's this you're giving me? And yeah, OK, now's the trick. Well, you say, I'll give you an answer, but there is no reason for it to be true. But are you OK with that? And since he's a Psi student, like the last group, then he would say, OK, yeah, that's great. And you say, OK, now let's do shanks on it. And when you do shanks on this series, it's really amazing that you would end up with a convergent series, which is really amazing. But yeah, there is no reason for it to be true. And it's actually not true. But yeah, it's just fun to know it. Now, Lin-Cheng is going to talk about WKB.
Hi, everyone. I'm here to give a review of general WKB. Suppose you are the physicist around 1926 when the Schrödinger just gave birth to his equation. You are quite interested in the time-independent Schrödinger equation. It is very hard to find out the exact solution of this, and you quite want to express it in a more abstract and general way about this problem. So you know that there's some mysterious ghost in the universe, and when he meets two times of the very crucial and dreadful differentiate, and it is very lucky that it should multiply a very small constant here, and this thing should equal to a kind of function that you know and multiply this very mysterious ghost. During the 1926, around that time, quite a group of quite smart people find out a very intelligent way to find this kind of ghost, following the philosophy that we can separate this very complex and mysterious ghost into a series of exponential or series of simpler and more easy to find out ghost. And we assume that the ghosts have the form of the exponential of a series of simpler to find ghosts. And in the asymptotic of when the delta is goes to when the delta goes to zero. So as you have already very familiar with and done a lot in the tutorial, we can substitute this assumption form of the solution into the equation and try to find and compare different power of the delta and trying to find out the simpler ghost. And here, because the delta and epsilon, delta is proportional to epsilon and they are the same order of the small amount. So we just assume they are the same. And here, to compare the power of delta gives out the first two terms of the simplest ghost, simpler ghost. Here, here we can generate it to the the order of n, and not just to here is the function that the ghost multiply. And omega is the root of this function. And this is the zero order of delta. And calculate the first order, you will get this. Where n is the order of this equation. It is very amazing that for quite a lot of equation, you just need to calculate a few of leading terms, just two terms, and can get very near exactly can get a very the approximation solution quite near the exact solution. And so the thing you care more about is the validity of this approach. And because we need this function asymptotic to some kind of function when delta goes to zero. So first we need this to hold the validity of this approach. And second, if you want, if you know that the solution when you know the solution when the n is smaller than the order of n, the sum of all these orders of this function is a quite good of approximation, then we need much more smaller than one, so that the exponential of this term, the exponential of the form of the solution will have equal to 1 plus a small amount of this order. Now, it's easily to see that there's some requirement about this function. From here, we know that if this guy equal to 0, then this term will turn to infinity. So we call that when the x makes this guy to 0, call that turning point. And the main idea to handle this kind of problem is this is the function that the goes multiplied to. And here you have some turning point, and you separate it into different regions. In the region quite near the turning point, this function can asymptotic to some maybe linear or more easier function, so that the equation degenerate to an easier equation. You can get an answer here, asymptotic answer here, and then use WKB get asymptotic answer between another region, and then you link the overlap together by let the two solutions equal with each other, and then get a general solution of the equation. The last thing I want to say is it is quite powerful because it is valid. It can be used in any linear equation with a small coefficient between in front of the lowest order of the differentiate and derivative. And here this function can be a operator, differential operator with the lower order of n. It will be valid in all this kind of problem, and it have the limitation that just used in the linear equation, but not the nonlinear. Okay, let's welcome one of the smartest physicists, Pedro, to introduce some more physical examples.
If I add pressure, now Lin Chen is just relaxed. Okay. So I'll complement a bit what Lin Chen did so well with these so funny images. So I'll talk about an alternative derivation of the WQB, very simple. And then I'll do some physical applications to see that it's not just some mathematical approximation. It was useful in the past. Okay, so I choose the one that is not working. So the Schrödinger equation in one dimension can be written as where P is the classical momentum. So The trick is to write the wave function in the form a to the I phi, where a is a real amplitude and phi is a real phase. And we plug this into here, and we'll have one equation for the real part, one equation for the imaginary part, which are so we'll be in the classical allowed region where this thing is real. And in that case, we solve this equation. This one is trivial to solve. This one, we do what is called a physical optics approximation, that is to throw this term out. And this is valid. A classical particle at a given point as a typical length skate is Compton wavelength. And the Compton wavelength will define when this is valid. This is valid if the Compton wavelength does not vary significantly compared to itself in a region of its size. So this is the condition for this to be valid. In that case, the wave function can be simply written as some constant over the square root of the momenta e to the I over h bar p dx. So this is the semi-classical approximation, and it's the same that we'd have reached and that we done in class with the expansion in powers of h bar of the wave function. So let's see the classical physics here. So if I plot the square of this wave function, I get the probability of the particle being at a given point being proportional to 1 over p. So this is also, this is a classical result. So if I have a particle moving in a place where at a given point she has a given velocity, the time that she spends at that place is this one. So if the probability of the parting being there being proportional to the time she spends classically there, so we recover this result in this semi-classical approximation. So if we are in a classical Frobenius region, the wave function will become will have a similar form, but now won't be an oscillatory behavior. It will be the exponential behavior, like that. In this approximation, quantum mechanics is trivial, right? I mean, we have the solutions. And this condition applies in several cases. The problem is that there are regions called the turning points where this breaks down. This becomes zero, so this blows up. So this is the only problem. But that will give us also some very interesting condition. Okay, so how is the time? So 5, okay, so I'll skip one thing. Okay, so one interesting thing that we have seen. Okay. Oh, I shouldn't erase my, okay. So one interesting thing that we have seen is that we have a problem of a quantum well. Here are the turning points, which are a function of the energy of your part. And so we know that WQB is valid here. Then here something is not very good. It's valid here, something happens here, it's valid here. So here at the turning points, what we do is that we expand the potential around that point. And we solve the equation using another method. So typically, the solution here will be an airy function if your particle is experiencing a force at the turning points. If it's not experiencing a force, you have the cylinder parabolic solution there. The interesting thing is that when we try to glue this WQB with this one, we have a very interesting condition. We have that px dx must be equal to an integer h bar pi, where n goes is 0, 1, so on. And I can write this in another form. I want to write the integral of the momenta along all the periodic trajectory of the particle. So it's twice this. And in that case, this condition becomes and this was a formula that was used in early quantum mechanics called the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization or quantum condition. So we recovered early quantum mechanics from WKV. Okay, just one. So okay. So let's see now the most remarkable example of WKV. So, okay, I have a particle that will experience some barrier, some potential barrier. It has an incident amplitude A, reflecting with B, going out with F. So I know from WKV that in the classical forbidden region, the wave function will decay exponentially. And I can relate, so the amplitudes of the particle is free, asymptotically free, far from the barrier. So I can relate the amplitudes. F square A square can write as e to the minus 2 gamma, where gamma is that integral in domain. Okay. So in the 20s, Rutherford was puzzled with something. They were doing experiments with uranium. And they were scattering alpha particles on it. And they measured the height of the Coulomb barrier. And they found that it was 8 MeV. But then they saw that the uranium was decaying and was emitting alpha particles with only 4 MeV. So how come were they passing the Coulomb barrier? So this was the first experimental evidence of tunneling happening in nature. And now tunneling is trivial with WKV. We just have to compute this gamma for a Coulomb potential, and we'll see that this thing decays as this thing goes as some fundamental constant z over square root of e. And so you know the probability of transmitting the barrier is related to the lifetime, and in the end. This predicts that the lifetime should be like that. And it's exactly what we get in experiment. OK, so I'm over my time. I will now let Hjalmar show a very interesting
place to see the WKV.
So I'm going to actually try to draw a connection between WKB and the semi-classical approximation to the path integral that we saw, for instance, in QFT2 when we found the effective action. And it turns out that they're actually equivalent approaches, a result from the 80s. So it's not completely trivial to show it. But I'm going to try to motivate it for you. To find this connection, we need to look at the time-dependent WKB because the path integral the path integral, we naturally have time. The time-dependent WKB wave function is given by 1 over square root of p as the classical momentum, as Pedro showed us, e to the I over h bar. Integral from x0 to x, p dx minus e t minus t0. So this is already starting to look a bit, and if you plug this into the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, you will see that it solves it to leading order in h bar. And this is already starting to look kind of promising. We have e to the I over h bar, so maybe we could get this to be the action. So let's look at the action. The action is given by integral from t0 to t of p of t dx dt minus h. And if we now restrict to the classical path, then dt here, then e is equal to, then h is constant and equal to e. And we can change variables to x. So we get the integral from x to x0 to x, p dx minus e t minus t0. So this is actually exactly what we have here. So we can write this as 1 over square root p e to the I over h bar and the action evaluated at the classical path. So we already see that WKB has a lot to do with the classical path. We have the amplitude of the classical path, and we have the classical momentum. How do we relate this to the path integral, though? The path integral doesn't give us a wave function, so we can't directly derive this from the path integral. What the path integral does give us is the propagator. And what I'm going to show you is that if we propagate the AWKB wave function with the propagator that we get from the path integral doing the semi-classical approximation, we will get back a WKB wave function at a later time. So it's sort of like an eigenfunction of the semi-classical approximation to the path integral. So the propagator we get from the path integral is this. S, where the initial point is x0, that is x1, and the final point is x2. Now we expand this around the classical path. And we then get this is independent. This is independent of the variation, so we can pull it outside. And since the first variation vanishes for the classical path, we get the second variation here, also at the classical path. Pulling this out, the rest of the integral, and this I will just quote, integrates to 1 over square root p at x1, p at x2, and integral from x1 to x2 dx over p squared. Okay, so now we have our propagator. Let's see what happens if we propagate a WKB wave function with this propagator. That is, we take the integral over g with psi WKB schematically. If I plug in what I have, I get so what we integrate over here is dx1 from minus infinity to infinity. I can't see that, sorry. And we get that first term, 1 over square root p of x1, p of x2, integral dx over p squared times. And the exponential there paired with the exponential here, which if we combine them is, I'll start here, is e to the I over h bar, integral from x0 to x1, p dx minus e0 t1 minus t0 plus integral from x1 to x2 p dx minus e t2 minus t1. And to evaluate this integral, we use the method of stationary phase. That is, what's in this integral, what's in this in these brackets here, when it's stationary with respect to x1, that gives us a value for x1. That gives us a value for x1 when this is stationary, and that's going to give the biggest contribution to this integral. So we use this as an approximation for the integral. And this will give us this will imply that the energy here will have to equal the energy of the initial in the initial state. And we end up with e to the I over h bar integral from x0 to x2, combining these two, p dx minus e t2 minus t0, divided by, this is actually squared since the wave function contains the factor of 1 over square root of p of x1. So we get the square root of p of x2. And here we get some factors, namely these, which depend on x tilde, and these turn out to be equal to 1. So what we have in the end is actually the WKB wave function at a later time. So it turns out that it seems like these approaches are actually equivalent. And next, Dalam will tell us a bit about complex energies in quantum mechanics, right?
Okay. I don't want to erase the pretty picture, so I think I'll to erase yours. Okay, so we've seen many times today and yesterday and actually during all the months that we've been here at PSI that it's usually a very good idea that when you have a problem that you don't know how to solve exactly, to introduce a small parameter, epsilon, which is normally taken to be real, and such that when epsilon is zero, you know how to solve the problem exactly, and then assume that the full solution with arbitrary epsilon is an analytic function of epsilon, so that we can find the coefficients, the hosts, if you wish. And then the solution to our particular hard problem that we didn't know how to solve exactly at the beginning, we will obtain it by setting epsilon to some particular value, let's say 1. And now it turns out that even more that we can learn even more interesting things, and even richer structure emerges when we do not only allow epsilon to become real, but also we allow it to live in a complex plane and assume that the perturbation theory gives us an analytic function in the complex differentiable sense. So I'm going to show you how this works and what can be learned from the complex perturbation theory of epsilon complex. So the best thing I think that we will see is that in quantum mechanics, where you originally start with a discrete set of eigenvalues. As you complexify the epsilon, you'll find out that somehow all the discrete eigenvalues are actually just one eigenvalue which lives on some continuous Riemann surface, which you get from gluing different parts of the complex plane. And to illustrate this, I'll use a toy model, very simple example. In quantum mechanics, just a two-level system. This is the original Hamiltonian, which is not very hard to solve. Right, and actually, even when I add the perturbation, which now contains the epsilon of the diagonal term, we could still solve it exactly because we know how to find the eigenvalues of a 2x2 matrix. But let's assume, for the sake of the explanation, that we don't know how to find eigenvalues of a 2x2 matrices, and let's just apply the perturbation theory and let's see what it tells us. So if we do this, then we find that the eigenvalues of the full problem, so the full problem is now that the new Hamiltonian is the original Hamiltonian plus the perturbation. We find that the new eigenvalues, there'll be two of them. Of course, to the zeroth order, one of them is A, the other is B, and then we have some perturbation series in epsilon, in the even powers of it. And the important thing is that here in the denominators, or downstairs, I don't know what's just numerator, denominator, probably denominator here, downstairs, A minus B appears. So that will turn out to be very important. To the 3, I guess. And now here we obtain precisely opposite values because the sum of the exact eigenvalues for arbitrary epsilon has to be A plus B, because we see that even when we add this non-diagonal term, of the diagonal term, then the trace is still A plus B. So the sum of eigenvalues have to be A plus B. So these will have to be the opposite sign. 2, 4, A minus B. Yeah, but the particular form is not so important, etc. So now we can try to stare at the series and try to think what it can teach us about the problem. And well, the most important thing is to actually find out where or whether it converges at all. And if you find even more series by the if you find more terms in the series, you will find that the radius of convergence is finite and is equal to A minus B, the absolute value of the difference between A minus B over 2. So this is only valid in this circle with radius R and complex plane of epsilon. So now I'm already assuming that epsilon is complex. And okay, well, the very interesting thing which we find when we do this series is also that when we look at this point where epsilon is purely imaginary, then we find that these two solutions coincide. So that's something quite surprising, right? We start with two eigenvalues which are completely different, A and B. Then we added some perturbation and found that at some point in the complex plane, they will always coincide. Quite surprising. And actually, even more interesting thing is that when you start with one of the eigenvalues, which is valid everywhere here, and you analytically continue it around this point where they are equal, you'll come back. But you do not find the same eigenvalue but the other one. So as you go around this point, by analytic continuation, the two eigenvalues swap. So this is already a strong indication, and if that something interesting is happening. And if you put all these hints together, it's almost, well, you can basically write down the exact answer immediately because you know that we have a double-valued function. We know what its special values are. And without much thinking, all this tells us that the eigenvalues, could guess them to be something like this. A plus B is here because it's the trace. And here because the radius of convergence. This is what I wrote. We'll obtain something like this, which you can verify easily that is the right answer obtained by the usual diagonalization or characteristic polynomial approach to finding eigenvalues. Yeah, so this also tells us more about why our perturbation theory failed beyond the critical region or beyond the region. Well, it's because this square root function has a branch point here and here. So we could either choose the branch cut to connect them, but I'd rather choose it to go away to infinity. And then, of course, we can. It's obvious that there is no analytic function which is equal to either of the eigenvalues here and extends to analytic function everywhere in the complex plane. So it has to fail at the branch point. The other interesting thing to note that this taught us, this complexification, is that the failure of perturbation, the complete failure of perturbation theory, which now happens when A and B are equal. So when A and B are equal, we have R equals 0. The branch points coincide. They're here, and the perturbation theory has 0 radius of convergence. And this is connected to the fact that we have the quantum phase transition when there is no gap between the two energy levels. So when the two energy levels merge, perturbation theory usually fails. A more interesting example is when you go to higher numbers of degrees of freedom. So this was just two degrees of freedom, but if you go to infinite dimensional Hilbert space, so let's say the quantum mechanics in 1D, I think Ali wrote down the Hamiltonian for the anharmonic oscillator. I'll write it again. So this is the harmonic oscillator, and we add the perturbation, x to the 4. So here, because we have infinitely many degrees of freedom, you'll also find infinitely many branch points and infinitely many Riemann sheets which are connected. And I'll just draw them schematically. So what happens is that we have infinitely many of these triplets of Riemann of complex planes where there's a branch cut along the negative real axis, which corresponds to the problem being unstable when epsilon is negative and real. And then we have a sequence of branch cuts and branch points converging to 0. So there are infinitely many of them here, infinitely many of them here. They are all connected. If we pass through this branch cut, we go between this triple. Like, we stay within the triple. And if we pass through these branch cuts, we pass between the different triplets. So this should be taken times infinity and infinitely many of these floors about each other. So I hope I convinced you that the complex perturbation theory can teach us a lot interesting. But if you still think that it's not so interesting to complexify the epsilon, Mohammad will tell you what happens when you complexify position and momentum and energy and similar things.
So as he was saying that, I'm just going to talk about some complex classical mechanics. So for this sake, first I will talk briefly about what's classical mechanics, which you may find it very boring. Mechanics, we have a system, classical mechanical system. We describe it by some Hamiltonian, and the equation of motion can be derived using Hamilton equation. Namely, if we have one-dimensional classical mechanical system, we have 2 degrees of freedom, the position and the velocity. We can find the equation of motion like this. X dot is partial h for partial p, and b dot is partial minus partial h over partial x. And if we have a classical mechanical system, and for the sake of the argument I'm going to present, we will take the Hamiltonian to be this is kinetic energy term plus some potential that depends only on the position, doesn't depend on the velocity. And we will take that this total energy of the system, it doesn't depend on the time, so it's just a constant. And if we apply the Hamilton equation for this system, we will get that our equation of motion is something like this, with some boundary, with some condition. If we take initial value condition or boundary conditions, some x naught and x. And we can take plus or minus, so this corresponding to the particle initially starts to the right or to the left. And I will take it to the right. So we can solve this equation, and if we assume that the energy is some constant and it's a real constant, and we assume that if we have some classically allowed region, like if we have a potential like looks like this, and we know that for some value of h, the classically allowed region is here. So if we started with x naught inside this square root will give us a real value. But if we start at some point outside this classically allowed region, we will get a complex value. The other way to get a complex value is to put just x is inside the potential. It's like we take some starting point here, for example, at x equals 0. X equals 0 at t equals 0. And then we add some complex perturbation to the energy of the system. And to motivate this, de Broglie, like if we try to trace back the idea of formulating the quantum mechanics in a hidden variable, as a hidden variable, and it's like firstly the de Broglie and others proposed that we can reduce any quantum mechanical system to a deterministic classical mechanical system using some hidden variables. And guess what? The hidden variables are just the complex values for the positions. And then it had some properties, and then was argued by others in 1960s that we can formulate all of the quantum mechanics using hidden variables ideas, but we look at the instead of looking at the complex numbers of the position in the coordinate space, we look at the complex values in the momentum space. This is just a motivation. I'm going to give an example, and we can see from the example that I'm going to describe now how we can get something classically, using some classical mechanical system, some phenomena like tunneling, adding some small complex perturbation for the Hamiltonian. So the example I'm going to describe will take the potential of some unit mass classical particle to be x squared minus some parameter g, small parameter x cube, and I'm assuming here that g is minus 1, and this potential looks like this. And this, we have two stationary points, one at 0 and the other one is at 2 over 3g. And this corresponding to the value of moment of potential 4 over 27 g squared. So if we take the Hamiltonian, for example, to be h equal 4 over 27, just this real number, we know that the particle will oscillate between these two points and it will never get out. But amazingly, and this is something I did on Mathematica, and it's something easily to solve, like you can solve this equation numerically. And if we add something like the Hamiltonian becomes something like this, and these are the numbers that I tried. So if we add this small complex parameter, we find that the x now will be, the particle will start. And the particle will start, and we have two turning points which corresponding to these values. But now the turning point will shift. The right one will shift down, and the other one will shift up. And we're starting from like x at 0 is 0, and x dot is positive. So we're taking the positive square root, like I've said before. And then the particle will start oscillating. etc. like this. And the remarkable thing that for this particular number, we find that the real, the maximum value for the real x after like 500 loops like this, the maximum number for the real x is around 31.6. Which tells us that, and if we look at the classical trajectory, we find that the particle actually spend most of the time in this place, but some of the time it spends this time here, which is corresponding to the tunneling. So now we have particle that is classically I forgot to mention that I took J to be 0.3. So for this value, like we know that this is around 2.2. So we know that classically the particle should be oscillating, the maximum x will be, actually if we do it for this value of g, you'll find that the value of x without adding this perturbation would be something between 0.4, minus 0.4 and 0.4, which is corresponding to these values. But now when we add just this small perturbation, we got something interesting that we can say that this is tunneling. The other example, if we take some periodic potential, we can get another phenomenon like backscattering. Like if we have a periodic potential like this, like minus cosine x periodic potential, for example, and we started with some energy, h is like the maximum of cosine is 1. If we started with energy 2, we know that classically the particle, and if we started initially the particle and pushed it to the right, the particle will keep going in this direction. But if we add some complex values, we'll find that the particle will spend most of the time in this direction, but some of its time will spend back, which is corresponding to the backscattering. And all of these are quantum mechanical phenomena that in 1960s people were trying to prove that they can formulate the whole of quantum mechanics in this set. And in a recent paper by Carl Bender, they showed that we can describe the band structure of some crystals by using some classical mechanical trajectories instead of talking about quantum mechanics. So I will end my talk by saying thank you for all of you, and I hope you have a good winter break.